I want to let you know that we're in our second week in our series called Welcome to Corinth, where if you have not been here, we're not here last week. What this is we're walking through a series on the book of 1 Corinthians. It's what we call 1 Corinthians is actually a letter that Paul, one of the Jesus' earliest followers, wrote to a small church in the Greek city of Corinth. Now, to understand this letter, in order to understand what God is trying to say to those people and to us 2,000 years later, you got to understand the city. So the city of Corinth was a wealthy city, it was a diverse city, and it was a port city. So it was right on the water, much like Seattle. It had a lot of money. It had a lot of diversity. So you had all these different people coming from all different parts of the world. You had people that were coming that believed one thing. You had everywhere from people that were Jewish, you had people that were Syrian, you had people that were Greek, you had people that were Roman. You had all around the Mediterranean area, Corinth was a place where people came. And because there were so many different people there, it was a very religious city, or you could probably say a very spiritual city. And they had all these different deities that they prayed to and these different gods. And so it was very pluralistic. It was like the world that we live in, that there was just a lot of different belief systems that existed in one small place. But probably what Corinth was most known for was it was known as a place where you went to live, and this was the phrase of the day, you went to Corinth to live as a Corinthian. It was a place that you went to do whatever you wanted. You could spend your money on all the pleasures that life gave. It was kind of like their 2,000-year-old version of what we say when we say whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, this idea that you get to go there and live your life and kind of do whatever you want, and then you get to leave. Because in the city of Corinth, there was this temple. It was this big temple. And by the time that Paul is writing this, this temple has been destroyed, but the history remains. In Corinth's history, there was this huge temple to the goddess Aphrodite. And if you know anything about your history, the goddess Aphrodite is the goddess of love. And sort of in order to express worship to the goddess Aphrodite, what you would do is you would go to the temple and you would worship. Well, how you worshiped was by having sex with one of the 5,000 prostitutes that they had available on the temple grounds. Seriously, both male and female. So that's how you worshiped. There was no back rooms, there was no curtains, there was no hidden anything. You went and openly worshiped Aphrodite. And so you can imagine now Paul plants this church, and this letter happens 2 years later, and he takes this tiny group of believers and goes, hey, I got a great idea. Let's put them in the middle of that and see what happens. And so you could imagine what type of maturity or what type of cultural environment these guys are facing. But part of the reason that we're doing this series is because ultimately we are Corinth. The world has not changed. Humanity has not changed. We have just made it faster. We have made it more electronic. We've maybe even made it more accessible and certain parts of it more legal. But it's the same culture because it's the same humanity. And so in the middle of this city, you get this small church that is being planted that is meant to be, as we are, a light to this city, that is meant to represent Jesus to this city. And they need a certain level of maturity to be able to handle the world that they live in, but what you find is the opposite. What you find is an incredibly immature church. What you find is a church that struggles with each other, that they're fighting and they're bickering and they're living their life in comparison with each other rather than a relationship with God in comparison with God's standard. What you find is people who are openly suing each other in court. And so keep in mind at this point, this Jesus guy is very unknown. I mean, we're talking 2,000 years later. I mean, it has been what, 50, 75 years since Jesus died and rose from the dead. And so we don't have the 2,000 years history. I mean, this is brand new in the Roman world. And so people are wondering, who are these Christians? And then their first interaction with these Christians is two of them walk into a courtroom and go, you suck. No, you suck. I want your money. No, I want your money. And you can imagine how weird that made it, or that was people's first impression of Jesus people. And then within their church, and don't shoot the messenger, this is gross, but it was really happening, is that within their church, they had a guy that was sleeping with his stepmom, and they just were like, okay, we're going to pretend it's not happening. Really? Because it's really gross and really uncomfortable. It's even uncomfortable to say out loud, but this is what's happening. And they just kind of go, okay, well, good luck, bro. You know, you do you. It's kind of gross, but whatever. They just don't do anything. And then one of the other things that's happening, which we arrive at today, is that within this church, these were people that had left an old life to now live a new life. But there were parts of the old life that hung around. And one of those parts that hung around was that there were still people within their church that were going up to the temple, and they were worshiping. They were still going up to the temple of the goddess Aphrodite, and they were still having sex with prostitutes. And so, with that uncomfortable intro, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. And Paul uses this in their life. Paul uses what is happening in this moment to bring out a much larger truth. And the truth that we've been walking through in this entire series is this, is that our culture and our church need mature Christians. And when I say mature, I don't mean mature as in, hey, and not mature in age, as in grow up so that you can pull your weight. Like, hey, grow up, kid, get a job, pull your weight, be responsible. No, no, no. Maturity in a spiritual sense means how much you are like and led by Jesus. How much of your life is like Jesus, and how much of your decisions in your life, how many of your decisions in your life are led by Jesus. That is spiritual maturity. And the reality is, spiritual maturity is actually the goal that we have for you as an entire ministry. I mean, my hope is that by the time you leave HSM, that you are a spiritually mature believer among your peers, meaning that you get to the point where you have real influence in the environments that you're in. Doesn't mean you're going to be well-liked. Doesn't mean you're going to be perfect. Doesn't mean you're going to do it as a sweet little angel and never make mistakes. But what it does mean is that wherever you are an influence of maturity, that you are led and like Jesus wherever you are. And I'll tell you what, if we're not in any way a part of that process as a community, if I'm not a part of that process as a pastor, if your life group leader is not a part of that process, then we have not done our job. Because you are called, and I am called, everyone, regardless of age, is called to be spiritually mature. It is why, and which is beautiful, I know 15-year-olds that are 10 times more spiritually mature than some 40-year-olds. Your age has got nothing to do with it. It's got nothing to do with it. So, stepping into a letter that Paul is writing to a church on this idea, it says this, chapter 6, verse 12. We've kind of been going issue by issue, and so we're jumping verses a little bit. Verse 12 says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful." And then in quotes again, "All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything." Verse 13, "Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both, one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body," which means the Lord is for the body's good. "And God raised the Lord, and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written," and this is in Genesis, "the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with them. Flee sexual immorality. Every other sin that a person commits is outside of the body. But the sexually immoral person sins against his own," or you could even put his or her own body. "Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God?" And this is where Paul says an incredibly lasting, powerful statement that is meant to alter every decision that we make, not just our sexual lives. He says, you're not your own. "For you were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body." Okay, so here's what's happening here in this verse. What we know is that people within their church are visiting prostitutes. And one of the things that Paul does is he uses this issue in their life to bring up something that was much deeper than sexuality. much deeper than sexuality. Now, yes, this is one of the ways it shows up, and we as a community are going to openly step into issues, especially when it comes to sexual issues. We get really uncomfortable in church. We feel like we got to write letters prepping people of like, hey, give us a heads up on November 6th, we're going to talk about sex, and it's going to get weird. Like, we have to like preempt that conversation, but we don't have to preempt that conversation because we're adults. And if there's any part of that that makes you feel uncomfortable, I'm sorry, that's not my intent, but this is the world we live in, and we as human beings, part of who we are is we are sexual beings. Now, we're going to unpack this in a much deeper and important level in January when we go through our series on the Song of Songs. But for this context, what Paul does is he uses sexuality to bring up a much deeper truth about who we view is in charge of our life and our world and our desires and our arousals. Whom is the one that gets the final say? So he points out two things that are happening. So there's two phrases, right? The first phrase that he quotes, and he's quoting what people have said back to him. And so it's hard to read sarcasm in the Bible. I promise it's actually in the Bible. When Paul is saying this back, when all things are lawful, in air quotes, he is doing it with a heavy dose of sarcasm. All things are lawful for me. Oh, he's got a little snarky voice attached to it. And he says, yeah, look, everything's lawful. And what it was their version of saying, look, I'm not hurting anybody. It's not illegal. I'm doing it on my own. It's by myself. I'm not hurting anyone. And Paul says, yeah, you're not hurting anyone. You're not hurting anyone else. But then he moves through that and says, but I will not be owned by anything, or I will not be controlled by anything. He says, in the end, you're actually hurting yourself. And then the second thing that he quotes back to them, something they've said to them is that, well, the stomach is for the food and food is for the stomach. It was their version of saying, well, it's just sex. It's just physical. I mean, if I was not designed to do that, then why would God design me the way that I am? It's just merely a physical thing. There's nothing else attached to that. And so these are what's happening is these are two excuses that these guys are throwing back to Paul of their way of saying, hey, Paul, I realize that I love the Jesus that you're talking about. I love the Jesus that saves me. I love the Jesus that gives me what I need. I love the Jesus that answers my prayers and helps me. But I don't want the Jesus that has any rule in my life, or more specifically, I don't want the Jesus that has rule in this part of my life. I want to be the exception to the rule. I want a hall pass. I want to get out of jail free card in this area so that I can do what I want. And the issue had nothing to do in the end with their physical body. It had everything to do with what was in their heart. The problem was not what they were doing with their body. That was just a symptom. See, the disease was that in their heart, they believed that they could do whatever they wanted as long as it fell into one of these two excuses. Because this is actually a mark of the truly spiritually immature. Those that have spiritual immaturity, the spiritual immature believe that they can do whatever they want. That is actually a mark of spiritual immaturity, is the belief that as long as it fits into this category, I can do whatever I want. Now, we may not use the excuses that they use. We may not ever use any of those two, but every one of us is going to battle with the internal excuses that we make as to why, in this area of my life, whatever the area is, whether it be sexuality or another area of our life, why I am the exception to the rule and I own my own life, I control my own life, and I then can do, because of that, whatever I want. So we say excuses instead, like, but they deserve it. I know God said, you don't do this to other people, but here's the thing, God, you don't fully understand. They deserve it. Or I deserve this. Or I need this. Or this isn't fair. So oftentimes we use fairness as an excuse to do whatever we want. We're going to be the ones to balance the scales. God, you are doing a bad job of that up there, so I'm going to make things fair in my life here. I can't help it. It's just who I am. It's just how I'm made. I can't stop. They did it first. I'm not the only one, or I'm not as bad. At least I'm not as bad as that dude over there who's doing it. Whatever our excuse is, there are ways for us to believe within our heart that we have the right to do whatever we want to do. What Paul is saying to them, and he's using sexuality to bring it up, he's saying, if you are a follower of Jesus, if you're a Jesus person, you don't get to do whatever you want to do. You don't. And that's a hard pill for us to swallow. That's a hard truth for us to take, because it goes against everything that we have been told as Americans from the day that we were born and lived in this country. It goes against everything that we were told. We have been told that we're masters of our own fate. We have been told to listen to your own heart above anyone else. We have been told that no one has say over your life but you. And that has been continually pushed and pounded into our brains, that we are the masters of our fate, that we, and what it really is that we are our own gods. And we have been told this continually. But what Paul points out in verse 20 is the core of this entire thing that he's talking about when he says, your life is not your own. And let that sink in for a second, because that is difficult to hear and difficult to take, because the implications of that for our life are huge. If you have a relationship with Christ, if you believe that Christ's death and resurrection counts for you, and he has made you new into a new creation, that you are living for him, your life is not yours. And that is opposite of everything that we have heard, but it is the definition of spiritual maturity, that the spiritually mature believe that their life is not their own. It is not an action thing. It starts as a belief thing. Paul says, look, I can run through your church and I could tell you, and I could put boundaries on you, and I could put accountability partners. I mean, I could put someone to stalk you as you walk through the entire city to ensure that you never go anywhere near the temple of Aphrodite. I mean, I could do all of those things. I could chain you somewhere so that it never happens. But none of that will ever take care of your heart, because what is going on in your heart is that you believe incorrectly about who is in control and who has the final say over your desires, over your arousal, and over your body. Jesus puts it this way in Matthew. Oh, let me go back. There we go. Matthew 16. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself or herself and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever, and this is just weird upside down logic, but for whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And Jesus is asking the question of who's in control. Whom gets final say in your life? If you buy the idea and buy the lie that I am my own God, even if I believe in God, but this in this one area, God, I'm still going to remain God. If I believe in that lie, the inevitable result of that is I will lose whatever I think I'm hanging on to. Is that I will mess that up, screw that up, because I am a sinful being. I am a bad God for my own life. I am. I'm a terrible God to follow, even for myself. And Jesus says, on the flip side of that, if there is admission that I am the one that is meant to run your life, that I am the one that is meant to rule your life, that I am the one that is meant to have the final say, then you will find what you have been looking for, and you will find even more. When Paul writes, that he says in that phrase, but God is for the body, he is going after the idea that God is good. And that everything that God desires for his people is fully and holy and perfectly good. That there is no wanting left in it. There's nothing in that leaves us unsatisfied. That God's desires for our life is, as it says in John 10:10, to give us a life and to the fullest extent possible. And so Jesus is asking this question, who's in control of your life? Paul is asking the same thing, and he is using sexuality as the way to do that, because, admittedly, there are few forces as powerful in our life as sexual arousal and desire is. Very few. If you think of the influences that happen in the human heart and life, there are very few that compare in power and might to the sexual desires of the human being. And that is not wrong. That's actually intended. That God intended you and I to live a life where our sexuality is a part of this good life that he offers to us. It is a part of not only pleasure, but as Paul points out, that the reason that sexual arousal and desires are meant to be so strong is because they are meant to bond two people into one person. That's why they exist that way. God sets it up all the way in Genesis. He says, okay, look, a man is going to leave his father and mother, and he is going to become one with his wife, meaning that is a lifetime commitment. And I will tell you that when you take two broken, busted, sinful people and try and put them together and make them one person, it kind of always doesn't go well. It just doesn't ever goes perfectly, but one of the bonding agents that is meant to keep two people together for life is that oneness and that sexual bond. And Paul is pointing that out. He says, look, when you go and you sleep with that prostitute, you are actually enacting what was meant to be done exclusively with one other person so that it helped bond you with that person for the entirety of your lifetime. Sexual desire and arousal, it is meant to be powerful. It is meant to be strong. It is meant to be an unquenchable fire that bonds two people together in a lifetime of commitment, because nothing else that strong could do it. It has to be exclusively something that is through and given by God to do that with two busted, broken people. And so it's there for a reason. But the question is, and the question that we wrestle with, and the question they were wrestling with, is in the moment of desire and arousal, who gets final say? In that moment, whom gets the final say over our desires? And if my life is my own, then I do. And everything is an option for me. But if God gets final say over my, even a force as powerful as my arousal and desires, then my actions ought to change and ought to be different because of that. So the question that works out for us is, if you're in a dating relationship and you are in the process, and you've been together for a while, and maybe you would even say, hey, we're beginning the act of falling in love. And one of the things that naturally comes out of that, because it is supposed to, we were wired this way. The issue is not the desire. The issue is the timing of the desire for us. We begin to have, hopefully, the sexual feelings or desires towards that other person. That's completely normal and natural. But in that moment, if I am dating that person and those feelings of love are happening, and also simultaneous with that, attached with it because it's supposed to be that way, feelings of sexual attraction and desire are happening, in that moment, whom gets the final say over that arousal and that desire? Do I? Does my boyfriend or girlfriend? Because one of the things when Paul says that your body and your life is not your own, he does not saying your life and your body belongs to your boyfriend or girlfriend. They got no right over it. They ain't your husband and they ain't Jesus, so they got no right. And they got no claim over it. And they can try and convince you, and maybe they are great, and they are super good looking, so it's really easy to be convinced. And whatever claim they're going to use to make it seem like they have a right to you, they got none, even if they act like it. And so the question is, in that moment, even in a healthy dating relationship, who has the final say over our desires? Who has the final say over my arousal and my desires? If I am alone and I'm in a room by myself and no one else will know that I'm looking at porn but me, who has the say over my desires in that moment? Because again, we could set up accountability partners. We could throw your computer or your phone out the window. We could have a whole weird burning ceremony where all electronics in your life are gone. I mean, we could go through all these physical acts to ensure that you don't step back into something that you know is shamefully wrong and you're in the spiral and that's why you're doing it. But all of that is still not going to take care of the heart that is internal in us that believes that even in that moment, as much as I believe in God or have a relationship with Jesus, in that area of my life, I'm still acting like I am God, I'm in charge, and he doesn't get a say. That's still what is going on. It is a heart issue. It is a desire issue internally. What about if you struggle with none of those things? Because one of the things that's also easy to do in church, especially when we talk about sexuality, especially from the stage, is it's very easy to assume that like everybody's doing it. And then it gets a little uncomfortable and they begin to assume things about people's lives that aren't actually true. And that's not true about this community. The reality is there's gonna be people in this room that are anywhere between the spectrum of they have had sex and maybe even had done so with multiple people and all the way to people who have never even kissed anybody or haven't even had the opportunity to kiss anybody. Hand-holding hasn't even happened. You've like awkwardly brushed up against someone. That was about it, and it was 10 minutes ago. Like that was the most that has happened in your life, right? So anywhere between those two things, anywhere between those two things is probably where people in this community are at. That's the reality of it. But what if you have never struggled with this? What if you have never in your life physically struggled with this, either going too far with someone that you're dating, or you have never struggled with looking at things that you shouldn't online, but in your heart, you still struggle with the boundaries that are put on you. And you still, to an extent, resent what has happened in your life. And you resent things that you can and cannot do. Maybe it's resenting because of boundaries your parents have put on you. Maybe it's boundaries that for another authority in your life has put on you. But in your heart of hearts, you don't like them. You don't think they're great. In fact, you detest them and you secretly resent them. And instead, what you are left is you are left feeling like you're looking on the outside in and you're wondering or fantasizing about what you could have or what you're missing out on. That heart is identical to the person who is acting on them. It is the same sinful heart. Whether you resent the boundaries put on you or you are purposely breaking the boundaries put on you, it's the same thing going on in your heart. It is equal in Jesus' eyes. He says, look, murder and deep seating, like just writhing hatred of another human being are the same thing. Because it is the same heart who murders, and it is the same heart who hates another human being enough to murder them. And it is the same heart who breaks God's boundaries, and it is the same heart who resents God's boundaries, but externally never does naughty non-church things. It's the same heart. And so the question is, for that person, is God still the one that is over and in charge and gets to speak into and rule your desires in your life? See, the idea that my life is not my own, it's meant to permeate every part of our life. Our money's not our own. Your money is not yours. I know you don't have like a ton of it, but it's not yours. You're like, man, I got like $7 and I've had $7 for a month. That's all I'm working with. Even that $7, it ain't yours. It's just not yours. And one of the things that, and I said it earlier, one of the things that is truly incredible is that how much you guys have given to two people that's going to change their life, like that has been the most encouraging thing to me, because it means a community of people is living that out, this idea that my life is not my own. Your time is not your own. My time is not my own. That one of our values, and we've been speaking this very heavily over the last few weeks, is that we are called to serve and be servants in every part of our life. One of the things that's so encouraging to me is over the last 3 weeks is that multiple life groups have been serving at the food bank or car care, or have been going to Edmonds and serving those fellow high school students who don't have food on the weekends and are bagging lunches and meals for their families. That is an act of living out a life that is not my own. Our life is not our own when it comes to people that are put in authority over us. What do you do when you've got a teacher or a coach or a parent that you struggle with, struggle to respect, struggle to agree with, but God has put that person over you? In that moment, is your life your own, or does God have control and ownership of your life and be able to speak into and decide your life? This idea that your life is not your own is gonna be huge for who you become. I said this a few weeks ago, that every one of you, especially in your relationships with members of the opposite sex, you are becoming whom you are going to be for your life. And one of the things, if you read a little bit further and you're like a read aheader and you cheat a little bit and you go into chapter 7 as Paul is writing, he says something very interesting in verse 4. Chapter 7, verse 4. He says that the wife's body of a husband and wife relationship is not her own. And in ladies, unless you think that somehow it's a sexist statement, he then follows it up with, and husbands, your body is not your own. It belongs, and the word is belongs, to your wife. It's this idea and a picture of what God does for us. It is two people in a relationship who treat even their own body as if it belongs to their spouse. This is why so many marriages are busted up, is because all the way back when that person was 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, they started believing the lie that their body and their life, everything was their own. So they get into this marriage and they walk into it where God says it's actually supposed to be two people becoming one. It's actually supposed to be two people who view their body in service of the other person, not themselves. Instead, what happens is they walk into that relationship and go, "What do you got for me? You better fulfill or else I'm out." That is why our families, our marriages, these relationships that were meant to be lifelong are busted, broken, and breaking up, is because you got two selfish people walking into it, looking at the other person, going, "What do you got for me?" Right now, who you are is who you're going to be when you're married. And if you are walking into the relationships in your life, viewing other human beings, including your friendships, including your life group leader, including the person you're dating, whatever it is, and you're looking at them as, "What are you going to do for me?" You are setting yourself up for a pattern of relationship that I promise you will be a major hurdle one day when you are married. Because the reality is most of you are going to be married, most of you are going to be parents. And what do you got for me is antithetical to being a husband and wife, and it is antithetical to being a dad or a mom raising boys or girls. It's the opposite. And we are called to be people that use what we have to serve other people. And it's an incredible picture of God's desire for humanity. It's an incredible picture of what God does, that it is ultimately he who gives up our life. It's why marriage is called a picture of what God does. It is God who gives up his life for the sake of us. And so then we're called to live that out with each other. To help flesh out this idea a little bit further, I have an uncomfortable question. I don't mean that in a funny way. I have a genuinely uncomfortable, difficult question to ask. So just for a second, put the notes down and all of that. And I want you to think what it would be like 2,000 years back. You are in the city of Corinth. Depending on your gender, it'll be easier to put yourself in this place. Most of the people that visited the temple, not shockingly, were men. Again, not a big surprise. Most of the prostitutes that worked at the temple were called priestesses, were women. Again, not a surprise. And so I have a very uncomfortable question. How many times in the history of that temple, and it was up for generations, how many times in the history of that temple do you think a man arrived at its steps and he decided that day he was not going to pay for his worship? He decided that day that he was going to take whatever he wanted. How many times do you think that there were men, very specifically men, that walked up to that temple, and because they were just prostitutes, they raped, abused, assaulted, and took from those women what was never theirs? And I would be willing to bet you that the percentage is probably shockingly high. We know this from percentages of women that work the street in our own cities. The rate of sexual abuse and rape and assault is astronomical. But the bigger problem is this. See, when I believe that my life is my own and I can do whatever I want with my body, it is not a very big jump in logic to begin to believe that I can do whatever I want with your body. It's a very small leap. It is not a big jump to view, if I can do whatever I want, then I can do whatever I want to you. Those two things are linked. Those two things are linked. And I will tell you, speaking, you know, splitting the genders as I'm saying this, in an over-sexualized and hyper-sexualized culture, which we are, make no mistake, we're Corinth. We are. We have the same issues that have been going on for 2,000 years. In a hyper and over-sexualized culture, the inevitable result is going to be the demeaning and the abuse and the harm of the women in that culture. It is going to be. It's something that we see in our own culture. 2,000 years later, it is still happening. 2,000 years later, we still have 4.2 million websites specifically dedicated to women that men can look at and fantasize about in all forms of sexual acts. Some of them truly physically damaging to the women that are in the videos and pictures. When one in five, let me say this again, one in five, and I understand statistics are tough, but we're talking about an average. One in five women on a college campus will be assaulted. One in five. If I'm a young woman, that's deeply scary for me. The idea of I'm going to go away to school, that's now a reality that has to be thought about. When over 90% of women, by the time they reach age 30, admit that they have been either whistled at, catcalled, grabbed, stared at for a long time, and everything in between, we as a culture, and let me be very specific, we as men in our culture have bought into the lie that our body is our own. And what our world needs and what our culture desperately needs is not more education. Our world does not need, and what men do not need, is more PSAs from the NFL on, hey, don't beat your wife and don't assault women. I don't need the NFL to tell me what is a shallow truth of a deeper reality that should be in scripture. What our culture needs, and very specifically, often what the women in our culture need, but simultaneously what the other men in our culture need, is men who grow up believing that their body is not their own. Because if you believe that your body is not your own, you will enact, you will live out a life of service to those around you. That is the answer, is we need men who are going to grow up viewing that their body is not their own, and simultaneously, therefore, the bodies of other people are there not for their taking, they are there for their serving. In humility, like Christ would. That is what our culture needs. And it's what our culture needs from all of us, is that you can imagine being in this environment. Think of it in these terms. Again, put yourself 2,000 years ago. What would have spoken to the people of Corinth? Christians who are suing each other in court, watching this, going like, aren't you a Jesus guy? Why are you going up to the temple? I thought you were supposed to be different. Christians who are judging one another and looking at each other and comparing who was better based upon how mature they were. That wasn't what the city of Corinth needed. What the city of Corinth needed and what our world needs was a group of people who viewed their body as not their own and therefore lived a life of service and humility to their city. That would be what is powerful. And when Paul says at the end, at the very end, he says, for you were not your own. You were bought at a price. In one sentence, he has described the entirety of the Bible. See, you and I were not our own. When we were our own, we screwed it up. We were left with the weight of sin that we could not bear. We were left with the price that we had to pay that we could not afford because of our sin, because of our sin nature. So God, being rich in mercy and love, said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pay for you. I am going to pay it for you. So he sends his son on our behalf. And what all of who Jesus was, all of his righteousness through his death and resurrection would be counted for us, and we would be called new creations. But in the act of doing this, the price for us to be made new would be the life of his own son. And so we were bought at a price. The price was steep. The price was high. The price was higher than any of us could pay. But we were bought for a reason. We were bought back from an old life to live a new life. We were bought back to be, as Paul says at the end of this, he says, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit. The temple was the place where people went to go meet God. That is our purpose in life. That when people meet us, they meet the God that has saved us and made us new and that we now represent. That is who we are. You are called the temple of the Holy Spirit. The temple was valuable. The temple was holy. The temple was a place where God dwelled. That is who we are called to be. See, the spiritually immature believe they can do whatever they want with their life. But the spiritually mature understand that if Jesus has bought them back, that their life is not their own. And what our world, what our city, what our culture, what our dating relationships need, what our marriages need, what our families need is mature people of Jesus who at their very core believe their life is not their own.